The successful property owners and developers are those that are able to adapt and anticipate and respond to the whole changing landscape, or they will be, as Darwin says, they'll just become obsolete.
Welcome to CREPN Radio for influential commercial real estate professionals who work with investors, buyers, and sellers of commercial real estate coast to coast. Whether you're an investor, broker, lender, property manager, attorney, or accountant, we're here to learn from the experts.
Welcome to Commercial Real Estate Pro Network's CREPN Radio. Weekly, we share interviews with real estate experts, passing on their experience and knowledge to our listeners. Thanks for joining us this week. My name's J. Darren Gross. We're so glad you're here. In just a minute, we're going to speak with Greg Lutke, an experienced commercial real estate attorney, about the challenging landscape retail malls face in the ever-changing world of retail. Retail, commercial real estate, change or die. But before we do, I want to invite you to subscribe to our program if you like what we're doing. You can do that by going to iTunes or Stitcher, and whichever you prefer, we're on both. It's really easy. You go into the search bar there, and you type in Commercial Real Estate Pro Network in the search bar. And when our logo comes up, it's the headphones with CREPN between the ears. Click subscribe. And this will ensure that you receive all of our episodes and you can listen anytime you choose, whether it's in the car, at the gym, or even at your kid's sports practice. When you do subscribe, be sure to leave a comment and let us know what you think. For those of you who don't know me yet, I am a real estate investor. I'm a commercial property insurance broker, and I've been an insurance broker for over 25 years. My primary clients are real estate professionals dealing in multifamily, retail, warehouse, office, and development. I'm also a real estate investor and have been for almost 20 years. And it's based on this, always looking for more information about real estate, that I created Commercial Real Estate Pro Network and CREPN Radio, so I can better serve my clients and use the information from my own investing. If you do buy, or if you're helping a customer buy real estate, it's always important to have your insurance in place. And if you have any questions about insurance, I encourage you to reach out to me and do everything I can to help. That's what I do. The best way, easiest way is to get a hold of me. You can reach out to me at jdarrengross.com, or you can also reach out to me on commercialrealestatepronetwork.com. And I want to remind you, too, if you're on LinkedIn, be sure to check out our group. We've got a LinkedIn group, Commercial Real Estate Pro Network. It's a great group of commercial real estate professionals, great way to network with other professionals. All right, let's get on with our show. Today, we're with Greg Lutke. We're going to talk about retail commercial real estate, the need to change or die. Today, I'm with Greg Lutke. Greg is a partner with the law firm Samuels Lowland Cantor LLP in Portland, Oregon. Greg, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Darren. It's a pleasure to be here as your guest.
Well, I'm grateful that you made the time for us, and I'm looking forward to our talk today. But before we get started here, if you could do me and the audience just a little favor and give us a little bit about your background and tell us a little bit about your practice.
Well, thank you. As we talked about before, Darren, I've been a practicing commercial real estate attorney for more than 25 years now, and I practice here in Portland, but I had been with a large shopping center company, General Growth Properties, for about 9 years, from 2004 to 2013, and returned to a private practice 3 years ago, where I'm now a partner at Samuels Lowland Cantor, continuing to do commercial real estate practice with a heavy emphasis on the shopping center and retail leasing. And for the past 15 months or so, I've been being kept busy with helping a large California apparel retailer roll out a new brand nationwide into open air and lifestyle type shopping centers. So my practice or my experience has been both in-house on the landlord and the tenant side, and again in private practice working with both developer and national tenants doing their lease expansions.
Well, in the time frame, you said 20, 25 plus years. Did I hear you?
Yes.
Here? Well, and I think that's to me is a very interesting look back in just what I've seen in retail, and I'm sure our listeners have seen as well, specifically with the big large retail mall. You know what it was, and I mean, I just think back about, you know, I grew up back in Kansas in suburbia, Kansas City, and I think if you look at the way the landscape developed, it was fields that became, you know, suburban sprawl kind of thing. But in those housing developments, the mall was kind of this big center for retail activity. I mean, I can remember, you know, we had a routine. You'd walk into the Sears and it was like walking into a carnival. You'd walk past that dishwasher that always had the glass front there, and you could see all the dishes getting washed. And it just seemed like an amusement park from a standpoint of all the, you know, what was going on and stuff. And I think from what I'm gathering, that was kind of the way that most of, you know, suburbia America developed. Is that, Do you agree with that, or is that, I mean, as far as the mall?
I think that was the typical paradigm, especially in the shopping centers that were developed in the 60s and 70s, and largely they were designed, I think, to coincide with the expansion of the interstate freeway system, and very often you'll find the locations near major interstate intersections, and in cities perhaps like Kansas City that you grew up in, if there was a ring road that surrounded the central business district, you would oftentimes find a major regional mall proximate to that because of the convenience of allowing the traffic and access in and out and back to wherever the people might be living. And then the recognition also that there was during that time period a heavy re-emphasis on suburbia. It's when, you know, most of the cities grew out from the ring roads and out and beyond. And that paradigm served the industry well for, you know, the better part of the 40 or 50 years. But now it's kind of a new landscape and a new ball game in many respects.
Right. And I think also one of the interesting things that I'm recognizing, you know, is from where it was to where it's going was that the malls I was, you know, intimately familiar with were all indoor malls, which were kind of a welcome retreat from, especially in the Midwest, whether it be a, you know, hot, muggy outdoor summer or a freezing cold winter, you know, to escape the elements and get inside and do your shopping.
Well, and I think that still holds true in many respects. I believe that there, the top enclosed malls, the most successful ones, what we would call in the industry the A, and I mean they're oftentimes graded by letters similar to the report cards that our kids get, but an A and A plus or even an A minus mall will still have many of those elements with the fully enclosed common area, where you may have larger big boxes or department stores on the end caps or say a Macy's or a Sears, a JCPenney, a Nordstrom, that kind of thing. And then in between, you would have smaller shops of varying sizes between maybe 1,500 square feet up to, you know, a minor anchor of 10 to 12,000 feet.
Right. You know, and I think the mix, and we could talk a little bit more about the mix of shops and all that, but, you know, I'm just kind of thinking here, and this is kind of what prompted this whole conversation. You know, I met the other day and had some coffee and thought it might make for some conversation that would be useful to listeners. The website I just was looking at here earlier today, the deadmall.com, I'm just blown away by how many malls have gone away. And, you know, the one that I grew up going to, this Metcalf South, was, it was like the center of the world. I mean, it was a huge, like 45 acre, you know, plot of ground that had, you know, this huge, I don't know how many 100,000 square feet the building was, with, you know, parking all the way around in that. I guess where I'm trying to go with this is, do you see, is there an area that is immune to this as far as the malls closing, or is it more incumbent on the owners recognizing the changing landscape and making changes?
Well, I think it's a multitude of factors, and I think you've hit on some of the main primary emphasis. I mean, in reality, there are probably a handful of owners of the major regional malls. Simon Property Group out of Indianapolis is the number one owner. The company I used to work for, General Growth Properties, based in Chicago, is number two. You've got Westfield, which is actually an Australian company, but has a heavy emphasis now in the U.S. with holdings. The Taubmans have some malls, and a few others, Mesa Ridge. These are all publicly held REITs, real estate investment trusts, and they are the top dogs and are very cautious and innovative, I think, in what it takes to maintain the vibrancy and viability and relevance of their assets. But an example is the company I used to work for, General Growth Properties. We had, as a result of the economic downturn, beginning in 2009, we actually underwent a major bankruptcy. It was the single largest bankruptcy in real estate in America, and that resulted in an ownership change and new managers and owners and CEOs coming in, and the idea or the emphasis there was to focus on retaining, prior to the bankruptcy and so forth, I think General Growth Properties had in excess of 150 properties nationwide in about 39 or 40 states or whatever. And during the process of reorganization, they shed off 35 shopping centers to a wholly owned subsidiary called the Rouse Properties, Inc., or the Rouse Company, also publicly held, at least until they went private last week, actually. That deal just closed yesterday. But in any event, the properties that were shut off to Rouse were the lesser tier malls in the smaller markets, but still very strong and vibrant properties that would be the best property or the best mall in that community. And the whereas so General Growth is now focusing on their top level, their A-plus malls like the Water Tower in Chicago, Fashion Show in Vegas, some in the major metro markets, urban mall areas in New York City and Atlanta, L.A., and even here in Portland and Seattle. The design or the requirement, I think, for all of these is redevelopment opportunities that arise when some of the larger boxes may close. Say, for instance, if a mall had a Sports Authority, that company just declared bankruptcy, and it doesn't appear that there will be anybody taking this over as a going concern, so that space, that 25 or 30,000 square foot box, may be appropriate either for backfilling with another tenant that may or may not need all of that space, or redevising and redevelopment of that. And the categories of the tenants there, or the operations that backfill that, may be entirely different in concept than what we saw when the malls were originally developed, because what you did not find in shopping centers that were developed in the 60s, 70s, and 80s was you would not have generally movie theaters, you would not have large restaurants, you might have a food court in the center of the mall, but you would not find your cheesecake factories and operations such as that. You would not find a athletic facility like a 24-hour fitness or an LA fitness or even a hotel. And now what you're seeing, I think, in the malls that are retaining their elements is those are the type of tenants that are deemed appropriate in this day and age for now consideration and inclusion in those properties, because the buzzword in the industry is called the experience. People want to have experiences, not just shopping. So a family may decide to go catch a movie, have dinner or a meal, and then do some shopping. But with shopping not being the sole and primary emphasis of the evening or the opportunity at the time at that property.
Right. That's interesting, you know, because you mentioned the, you know, just the change. I'm sitting here kind of thinking about, again, my youth. It was pretty much, it was kind of destination shopping. You were going there to get some shoes or, you know, at least in my family, my parents were very specific about what we were doing. We weren't to go kick around the mall kind of people. But you're right, how the, you know, a big restaurant, I don't ever remember, I think it was like an Orange Julius was the restaurant in the mall kind of thing. But now you can clearly go to the mall and you know, have some fine dining. I'm curious, is there anything that the industry points to that changed this? I know you mentioned kind of the economic downturn. Is it all kind of wound up in a just change in general, or is there any one thing that you know the industry points to? I mean, is the internet? Is there any?
Well, yes, and I think obviously the internet and the rise of the popularity of Amazon and other online shopping has necessitated, you know, really a true paradigm shift in the idea of concept of retailing. And the reality is that you either adapt and retain your relevance. It's kind of like Darwinism, I guess, at its best in the retail industry. A owner of an asset like the property you described there in St. Louis area, you know, if you looked at the reasons of that cycle or why it lost its relevance, you might find a multitude of factors, including the changes in the demographics in the area, whether it was competition from other properties that drove the people away, that because people are attracted, obviously, for newer and more exciting opportunities. So the successful property owners and developers are those that are able to adapt and anticipate and respond to the whole changing landscape, or they will be, you know, as Darwin says, they'll just become obsolete and lose their relevance.
Right. Is the answer, the experience, is that universal? I mean, is it... You know, if you go to, you mentioned your the place where you worked before, how they sold off those 35 more kind of regional malls. Is the answer for their relevance the same as it is in more of the Class A properties? As far as, I mean, just is that experience, is that really what the industry is recognized as the answer?
Well, yes, and just by coincidence, the Rouse Company was, as a spinoff, the company that had put in a lot of money that assisted General Growth with being taken out of bankruptcy is actually a Canadian concern, Brookfield Asset Management. They're based in Toronto, but they have a large presence in the U.S. and many holdings in New York. And they just closed. It was announced earlier this year, and it was just closed, where they bought the remaining 65% of Rouse Properties that they didn't already own, and are now taking it private. So RPI is now delisted from the New York Exchange, but those 35 properties that Rouse still owns, say for instance, there's two properties in the Pacific Northwest or Pacific Northwest area that where you and I live. There's the Gateway Mall down in Springfield, Oregon, which is about 75 miles south of Portland, and another one north in north of here near Longview. And on the Gateway Mall in outside of Springfield, Rouse, over the past 2.5 years, has done a total renovation and almost a demalling of that property, removing many of the enclosed areas and replacing them with retailers that have a direct presence from the parking lot. In other words, you don't need to go in through the main mall and wander down the small shops. It's been re-merchandised and replenished, and now has a good offering of restaurants, activities, theaters, and so forth. And that is really what you will be seeing, I think, from the continuing industry is very calculated decisions and reinvestments in those assets by the developers to keep them thriving.
And, you know, on that reinvestment and I heard you say kind of that direct access from the parking lot. It's funny because I think that was kind of what strip malls were before the big malls were. Is this kind of like we're going back where we came, only new face? Is that?
To some extent, I mean, and in contrast, in the urban, you know, like say, for instance, in Chicago, where my wife and I lived for 3 years, there you have vertical malls, meaning multi-story retail. They're at the water tower. They're in downtown Chicago, for instance. There's 9 or 10 floors of retail. You see it in San Francisco. There's some properties here in Portland. And so you even see that type of, so they may go vertical in the larger communities that can have that density sufficient to sustain that type of shopper or people, and those still have, so instead of being spread out or surrounded by a sea of parking, like you would see in your suburban malls, like the one you were discussing at the outset, they'll be going vertical.
Right. And I'm just curious, you know, because this kind of comes back to that, you know, the move from when the housing collapsed, the housing market collapsed back in, what is it, 08, all of the development, or not all of the development, but a significantly large percentage of the housing market has come into the urban core, and I know specifically here in the Northwest, and I think it holds true for most of your major markets, the multifamily and condo development in more of a vertical landscape like you're describing. I'm curious, have you seen the urban malls? Have they been affected by this? I mean, are there urban malls that are going dark? Like, you know, the ones I'm thinking of in my youth are clearly suburban situations. Have you seen, is the urban mall, is it suffered the same fate? Or has it had to work as hard to reinvent itself as the suburban malls have?
I that's an excellent question, and I think the answer is potentially if the owners of those assets don't respond appropriately. And I think a prime example of that would be really a property that I remember when it was brand new here in Portland called Lloyd Center, which is on the inner east side. So your readers know, Portland is divided by the Willamette River, which separates the east side from the west side. And the east side is the downtown central business district is just on the west side of the river. And in the 1960s, the Lloyd property was developed, and that was a the largest at the time it was built in around 1960 or 61. It was at that time, for a short period of time, the largest shopping center in the country. And that had had big boxes, Montgomery Ward, Nordstrom, Sears, Penney's, and so forth. And then it was later re-renovated and enclosed. It also had an ice rink and a lot of small shop space. And it used to be, you know, Macy's or well, we have Meyer and Frank here before Macy's bought them out. And that has undergone several transformations over its lifestyle. And about 3 years ago, it was sold by the former owner to a company based out of Dallas, Cypress, and they are undergoing currently a major renovation of that Lloyd Center. The unfortunately, they lost the Nordstrom store, but they are backfilling that Nordstrom store with an offering of innovative restaurants and new shoppers, and we'll begin seeing the, I think, reemergence and renaissance of that property here over the next year as they finish off and complete. They're going to be redoing the main entry and creating a new focus of that property, and I think it provides a good case study or analysis of what it takes to for those types of urban assets to maintain their relevance in the industry, because it could otherwise have been slated to a fate similar as you described, where it just wouldn't be appropriate any longer.
Yeah, and even, you know, the Lloyd Center is an excellent example. Just even if you take a look at what's going on right there in that neighborhood. I remember when I first moved to Portland, the office I worked out of was literally it was connected to the building. We could walk, take the sky bridge from, I think, the second story from the office building. We could walk over right into the Nordstrom's. And I'm trying to think, it's probably been a couple of months now that I've been over there. But if you drive down in that area, there's, I don't know how many new condo kind of living multifamily buildings that are being built right there in proximity to that that mall, which I'm assuming would bring a lot of new potential, you know, shoppers into the mall there and with money to spend. I mean, you know, that whole neighborhood's gotten redeveloped. And I think that, and this is something that I think our listeners should probably understand too, that, you know, Portland's unique with the urban growth boundary in that there's that, an imaginary line that circles the city, and they've said, hey, look, development can't go beyond this line, which then I think then also gives all of the neighborhoods a chance to redevelop themselves and you know, be new again, as opposed to some of the urban sprawl or suburban sprawl rather, areas that I'm familiar with from back in the Midwest. But that's an excellent example. And I'm sure that'll be a study that people point to as far as how to revitalize a mall and even a neighborhood, for that matter.
Well, and looking at the broader picture, I think there's two factors that are maybe important to bring out. It is, as the baby boomers continue to age, And the empty nesters, what we're finding is they prefer to return. I mean, they typically, when they start having their families, they would be moving out to the suburbs, into the subdivisions, raising their families, and they would be the primary shoppers for the Washington Squares and Clackamas Town Centers and so forth that are on the ring road surrounding Portland. But they are electing to sell the family home and move in to smaller quarters like the Pearl District, which is extremely popular here in Portland, the south waterfront along along the Willamette River. And they like proximity to restaurants and shopping and don't like driving. They may downsize from two or three cars down to one. And so you've got one demographic there. The other one is what we're seeing a lot is in the millennials, the ages 18 to 34, which are now the largest constituency. They actually outnumber the baby boomers. First time a generation has done that. And there you have people in the computer code programmers and technology area. The millennials also like to live in a community, and I've been to a lot of presentations focusing on, well, what do the millennials want? And they want many of the same thing that baby boomers want, which is they want to live in a community such as the one that's being developed there around the Lloyd Center, where you have apartments and condos, and they can either walk or bike to their place of employment. The Portland downtown area has become a mecca for computer programmers and developers, application support and so forth, because that is where the popularity is. And if you look at the Portland and Oregon is fortunate to be either, depending on which poll you look at, we're either number one, two, or three in popularity for attractiveness for recent college graduates because of the lifestyle. So it really becomes incumbent upon cities and communities and public and private partnerships to provide the appropriate infrastructure and amenities and so forth that are attractive, because in order to thrive and maintain their viability, they need to continue to be attractive for these people coming in and having the jobs, because of course that's the engine that drives this whole economics.
Right. In that, you know, kind of brings up kind of that question. I would assume there's a lot of strategy put into deciding where to purchase or operate a mall, or even you know, clearly retail, but clearly to know the demographics and is there growth? What's coming in the area? Kind of thing. I think that, you know, because clearly I find it fascinating, you know, blame it on the baby boomers again, kind of thing. They've changed their mind. They want something different. Now we got to, move to their step. But how the millennials are now more of a force to be reckoned with as far as their, spending or their wants, and kind of recognize what's coming, as opposed to keep trying to put out the come to the suburbs a message. Kind of thing.
No, it you know, and it's kind of like the film with Kevin Costner from a few years back, The Field of Dreams, although the focus there was on baseball. But I think there is some parallels between that and the idea of putting the enclosed regional malls out in the suburbs, because that was where the growth was.
Right.
But still, I'm not at all suggesting that those types of properties are not still thriving. I mean, Washington Square in out in the area where closer to where we live, I'm actually out in the suburbs again. that is probably one of the most successful properties in Oregon. You've got the Clackamas Town Center, which is over on southeast Portland, or out in the on the way to Oregon City, but it's at the convergence of I-205 and which is the ring road on the east side of Portland. That is still extremely successful. You've got a relatively new development, and I think it's been open about 10 years, called Bridgeport. In contrast, that is an open-air or lifestyle center where the shops, it looks more like a streetscape or what you would find in an urban downtown area with streets, and you'd have these storefronts, and then there's a parking structure, a parking deck for the parking, but in contrast, it's not like Clackamas or Washington Square where you've got a sea of parking with the shopping center in the middle of it. But even at Washington Square and recently at Clackamas, they both did major expansions and renovations and creating wings where you have the streetscape focus with new retailers having a direct presence visible from the freeway. And it looks more like you would see if you were going into a downtown area.
Right. No, excuse me. All of that, even that kind of that sidewalk cafe, kind of coffee or dining or whatever. Just that outdoor, bringing the indoors outdoor kind of thing is. I find it attractive myself. I mean, when you are looking for that kind of stuff, it's kind of nice to have that option. Just kind of thinking here that what I'm really kind of, I guess my summary on this is that when I was a kid, the experience was asking your mom to go get a different size or different color pair of jeans to try those on, or the salesperson. Now it's the that's not enough. The experience is, it's more about the entertainment of the, like you said, the whether it be dining or movie or the workout or the hotel kind of experience, and just kind of evolving. It's fascinating to me how it's all it moves. I mean, because forever landlords have always been faced with the a vacant space. How do you fill that space? And we've all seen the spaces where the tenant moves in, and no sooner do they get moved in, they're moving out, or they're out of business sale kind of thing, and it just didn't work. But it seems like the what I'm hearing from you and seeing is it's create that experience for the shoppers, and that's what's working right now.
Well, and also I think it's a reality, and no one will underemphasize that these shoppers are much more astute and have access to much greater information, and will oftentimes do a fair amount of online reviews or previews of the items that they're seeking, and then physically go to the property to be able to see them in tangible rather than just viewing them on their iPhone or computer. And so the successful retailers are ones that are recognizing that and doing what they call omnipresence or omni shopping, in catering to that type of thought, where anticipating that people come in almost exactly knowing what they want, and will either have it held there for them to pick up, or be willing to wait and have it delivered to them, almost immediately. And so it's really created an interesting pair or dynamic, I think, between the online shopping capabilities and the fulfillment through Amazons and so forth. And what you see in the bricks and mortar locations, but always there's almost always a fair amount of impulse purchase, there's ancillaries, and that's really the benefit of being having to have a physical presence. You can get that supplemental sale that you might not otherwise get strictly on inline or online.
Right. Now, it's funny, you know, listening to you, the you know, just all the additional information, no more of that, you know, the Sears Christmas wish book where you stared at something forever, hoping for it to show up on Christmas. Now it's, I mean, you think about all just the volume of information that's available to the retailer, or not to the retail, but to the shopper now. And, you know, just the gobs and gobs and gobs of information. And, but I mean, it's just kind of, like you said, the transformation, the shopper now is much more, educated. They know more what they want when they show up. And now it's more of a kind of a pickup point. And like you said, the opportunity for additional sales, it's interesting just how it's all changed.
Yeah, and what you're also seeing is the retailers themselves are taking advantage of the online experience, recognizing that the people have their handhelds, and say, for instance, what you reach close proximity to a retailer, they're getting to the point now where you will get an e-blast or whatever on your handheld device announcing a discount or a coupon then and there, and as a way of luring or enticing that shopper to come in and take a look at what that retailer is offering.
Right. No, it is definitely an instant world. You gotta stay in front of that consumer. If you're not staying in front of the consumer's getting the message from somebody else and you know, likely to buy if that's what they're in the mood for or what they're looking for. So definitely a changing game. But well, Greg, I'm looking down kind of my you know, list of things that I had kind of outlined. Is there anything that I haven't asked you about, just kind of this changing landscape in retail that you would have liked me to ask?
No, I think we've pretty well covered it. I mean, a couple things is I'm very involved with the primary, at least on the landlord and development side. There's the ICSE, which is the International Shopping Center Council, is the largest trade organization, and they have numerous conferences around the country and a big powwow in Vegas every year and other meetings, regional meetings and conferences, all dealing exactly with these type of topics. And you know, it really is, I think, a fascinating opportunity and experiment for people to see. I keep focusing on Darwinism, but it really is true. It's either retain relevance or you're going to be put in that website of the dead mall. And so there are much more billion people than I, you know, or that are, this exactly what they focus on, and not everything is going to be successful, obviously, but they need to, I think what they're doing is they're adapting and embracing, and it's creating an exciting opportunities. You can't just sit back and wait. You have to be anticipating and ahead of the curve and continuing to evolve and stay up with the crowd. So it's an exciting time.
Well, change is always exciting, especially if you're on the go forward as opposed to the they left without you, you know, part of that. So. But, well, Greg, I want to say thanks for taking the time to talk about this. And I hope you've enjoyed yourself and would agree to come back and we can do this again.
I look forward to it. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Hey, before I let you go, do you want to put some contact information? You want to give the listeners some contact information if they wanted to reach out to you?
Yes. The last name is LUTJE. First name is Gregory. I'm with Samuel and Cantor Law Firm here in Portland, and our website is www.samuelslaw.com. My email address is glutje@samuelslaw.com, and the phone number is 503-226-2966.
Great. And I'll put all that in the show notes here so people can click on that if they'd like to do that.
And I'm also viewable on LinkedIn and the firm website as well.
Got it. Greg, thanks again.
Thank you, Darren. Have a great weekend.
Well, the only guarantee in life is change. And the retail mall is facing that head on. It's either change or die. I hope you found today's interview interesting. It's a riddle, the change. What is it that retail customers are wanting? And it's a riddle that commercial real estate investors, brokers, and retailers all face. How do you change to meet the customer's expectations? Before we get out of here, I want to make sure you remember, if you haven't already, to be sure to subscribe to our program here. You can do that on iTunes or on Stitcher. Just type in Commercial Real Estate Pro Network in the search bar there. And that way you'll know exactly when a new episode goes live. We know you're busy, and we thank you for making time for us today. We do appreciate you. Until next time, thanks for listening to Commercial Real Estate Pro Network's CREPN Radio.
You're listening to CREPN Radio for influential commercial real estate professionals. For more information on this or any of our guests, like us on Facebook, CREPN Radio.